We are going. I'm going to call the Minnesota House of Higher Education Finance and Policy Division to order. Members, please take your seats. There's no members to take their seat. So it's looking like It looks like people are recovering from our long meeting last night. Thank you very much for participating. I was proud of our committee for being efficient in our use of time. And so thank you all for having a late joint session last night for our regent selection.
Well, thank you for running the meeting, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you. Senator Anderson and I have been working pretty well together, so that probably showed a little bit last night, but I enjoy working with him and all of our members on our committee, so thank you for all being a part of that. We we'll just wait and approve the minutes in a little bit or after our presentation. Oh, there we go. We now have a quorum. So would anybody like to approve the minutes for February 13th, 2019?
Hi, Madam Chair. I would like to move the minutes.
Okay. Representative Vang made a motion to approve the minutes for February 13th, 2019. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails, and the minutes for February 13th, 2019 are approved. Today we have with us the Office of Higher Education, and they're going to be presenting us a state grant program and presentation. We have with us Meredith Fergus of the Manager of Financial Aid Research. Ms. Fergus, it's Fergus, correct? Did I get that right?
Correct, Madam Chair.
Welcome to our committee, and we'll also have some other presenters as well, and then you'll introduce them at the time, or would you like me to introduce them now?
Madam Chair, other presenters as needed.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you. So we have on hand Nicole Whalen, financial aid analyst, so all of our members know. And Tricia Grimes, she was the one who just stood up and talked, legislative liaison at the Office of Higher Education. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Fergus, and we look forward to your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Meredith Fergus. I am the Manager of Financial Aid Research and the State Longitudinal Data System SLEDS for the Office of Higher Education. So I put together some slides kind of giving you background on the Minnesota State Grant Program. And so for today's presentation, I thought we'd cover just some program basics to kind of let you know where we are currently, some of the detail around award formula and policy that is set in state law, as well as statistics. And then, of course, I would welcome questions at any time. So the Minnesota State Grant Program is the state's primary need-based grant program. Students apply by completing the FAFSA. This is the same application that is used for federal Pell Grants. Minnesota is unique in that our application deadline is actually 30 days after the start of classes. Most other states set a deadline of March for their applications. What this means is that Minnesota has a higher participation by students from the two-year sector, as well as low-income students who may delay college enrollment decisions until summer. That also provides us a little flexibility in that for students who start classes but may not realize that they need to apply for financial aid, we give them additional 30 days to get that application in and make sure they get funding. If they do miss the fall deadline, they can, of course, apply again later in the semester and then start receiving state grant in spring. Approximately 82% of our new entering resident undergraduates do complete the FAFSA. So among college-going students, we have a high FAFSA filing rate. However, among all high school students, we actually have a low FAFSA filing rate, and part of that is due to our higher dropout rate in high school. Students who are not on a college-going path do not file the FAFSA.
Ms. Fergus, could you just do me a favor and just slow down your presentation a little bit? I appreciate your efficiency, but I think I'll probably grasp it more if you just slow down a little bit. And since I interrupted you to do that, I just wanted to recognize Commissioner Olson, who is the Commissioner of Higher Education. He is here with us today for a part of our meeting, so thank you for coming. Okay, Ms. Fergus.
Most certainly, Representative Finardi. I do tend to talk fast. Among Minnesota residents, approximately 59% of all students who apply do receive a state grant, and that equates to 44% of all Minnesota resident undergraduates enrolled. We had last year approximately 136,000 applicants. This is down from our high in fiscal year 10 of 200,000 applicants. And we had just over 80,000 recipients last year and at 91 participating colleges, spending $198 million. The state grant operates budget-wise on the two-year cycle. We do project out our spending every November 1st and February 15th. And what we essentially do is we're evaluating the applications that come in to make sure we have adequate funds within the budget or within the appropriation to award all those students. Given this is the second year of the biennium, most of our reporting this year actually focuses on cash flow versus what we projected we'd be spending. Yep. The state grant is not a forecasted program, so we do have to monitor cash flow closely. In terms of policy, should we get into a situation where we may have too much money in the state grant program or not enough, we do have authority within state law to transfer between programs at the Office of Higher Education as well as between fiscal years within that two-year budget framework. We can also, in the second year, adjust grant awards to accommodate short-term deficits or surpluses to ensure that we stay within appropriations at all times. In terms of financial aid policy, the state grant program is based on what we call promoting access and choice under 136A-095, set in 1971, that the legislature finds and declares that the identification of men and women of the state who are economically disadvantaged and the encouragement of their educational development in eligible institutions of their choosing are in the best interest of the state and the students. Now I'm going to go a little more into the policy detail about the state grant program. The primary policy framework that the state grant program is built on is called the Design for Shared Responsibility. And what that means is that the price of attendance or the price of college, which is equal to tuition, fees, and living expenses, should be split among the three groups that are going to benefit from that education: students, families, and taxpayers. And, of course, by taxpayers, we do mean the federal government in terms of federal Pell Grants and also the state in terms of Minnesota state grants. In terms of the technical details, the parameters are set either within statute or session law. So for this year, the cost of college is based on the recognized tuition fees, which is equal to the highest average tuition fees charged at a public institution. So that would be the University of Minnesota Twin Cities for four-year programs and Normandale Community College for two-year programs. That is the fee amount that we allow private colleges to be awarded under. In addition, the living and miscellaneous expense allowance is also set in statute. It is currently set to 101% of federal poverty guidelines, and so it increases by approximately inflation each year. However, this year, due to some surplus funds from year one of the state grant program, we are able to do a short-term increase and increase that to $9,900, which is approximately 109% of poverty level. The living and we'll talk a little bit more about how those benchmarks are set in a few slides.
Ms. Fergus, I wanted to ask you a question. Are you going to be talking about any of the proposals today? Are you going to wait that the governor just announced? Are you going to wait and come back and talk to us about the budget?
Madam Chair, I was actually going to reference them as I went along.
Thank
in those
you.
Sections in the
that.
Detail. However, I don't have any exact data visualizations to show you how it's going to play out. That'll be the next presentation.
Thanks, Ms. Fergus. If you could just make sure that we're aware, keenly aware of when you do that, because I was just starting to want to write those down. Thank you.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. In terms of who should pay for the cost of the student's education, the first 50% is assigned to the student, and in state law that's referenced as the assigned student responsibility. The next payer would be the families, and they are assigned an assigned family responsibility, which can vary anywhere from 0 to 50% of the cost, which this year maxed out at $12,345. The remaining cost, which is not covered by students or families, is considered to be the taxpayer responsibility. And it also can vary from 0 to 12,345, the max out point for this year.
Ms. Fergus, we do have a question. Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is this. So on the slides, it always talks about a dependent student. What happens to the independent students? Do they carry then two-thirds of the burden themselves, or does the formula shift?
Ms. Burgess.
Madam Chair, Representative, independent students are recognized within the St. Grant program, and they are expected to pay both the student contribution and the family contribution. So, yes, they do get two payment assignments.
All right. Thank you very much.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just wanted to ask about, it looks then like for each student, there could be a different number of state. The state grant will vary for every student. Is that correct?
Ms. Burgess.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. It varies not only by the income and assets of the student and their family. It'll vary by their enrollment level. It will vary by the cost, the tuition fees charged by the institution. Yes. So it literally will be a dollar-by-dollar calculation.
Thank you.
Very similar to tax policy.
Yep. And, Ms. Burgess, I also have a question on that. I had students visiting me today from Lead, Minnesota, and they were telling me that they need to – I mean, some of them are working a lot of hours, like two jobs. One said 60 hours a week, and they want to stay full-time status because they're going part-time, their financial aid is affected. Will you be talking about that today, or is this a good time to comment on that?
Madam Chair, absolutely. We'll be talking about the work burden of students as well as their loan burdens in a few slides, yes.
Okay, and part-time status as well.
Yep.
Thank you.
So the next few slides are just a visualization for you to kind of get a better picture of how the state grant program operates. This one is built on a dependent student going full-time at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. So you can see they will be paying approximately $14,790 in tuition fees. The state then designates $9,900 in living expenses for them. Of those combined costs, the student will pay the first half. So $12,345, and they are expected to pay it through either loans, work, or if they receive contributions from relatives or other sources. The remaining part then is assigned to the family, and that is based on the results of the FAFSA or the federal need analysis, and I'll talk about that a little more in a second. Then the Pell Grant is applied, and that remaining spot is then filled in by the state grant. Should you decide as a committee to reduce the payments of any of those groups, the state grant would kick in and fill in the rest to the extent that appropriations are available. Yeah. In terms of what the student sees, they actually see a chart that's more like this. They will receive their tuition bill, of course, at the beginning of the semester, from which the college will automatically apply the Pell Grant and the state grant. And then if there's any remaining bill left, the student would be asked to pay for it. As well as any living costs that occur on top of that tuition fee charges. And so by income, you can see that even our lowest income students at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities are expected to pay more than $12,000 out of their own pockets each year.
Yep. Ms. Fergus, so I just want to, this is how I understand it, that the by having living expenses applied to it, if a student chose not to live outside of their home with their parents, if they're a younger student, that for some students, the actual funding that they get from the state would cover their tuition. Is that accurate?
Madam Chair, in most instances, it would actually not at the University of Minnesota, but it may at the community college or the state university level.
Okay, thank you.
And I actually have some slides at the end about that.
Okay, Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In determining income for either the student's income or the parent's income, does that require actual tax returns, or how is that established?
Ms. Burgess.
Madam Chair, Representative Norris, yes. The students, when you log onto the FAFSA, I don't know how many of you have filled out a FAFSA in the last couple of years, but you can do it on your cell phone now. You can also log into the website. You receive an ID for login. And it will ask you to either enter your tax return information or offer you the option of transferring your TAC records from the IRS to the U.S. Department of Education. So, yes, it does ask for basic tax information. So, typically, we're talking about the adjusted gross income from the tax form, but also any kind of assets the parent or student may disclose at time of filing to the U.S. Department of Education.
Okay.
Representative Norman.
Madam Chair. So, I guess I could understand probably the students. Sometimes it's quite complicated if the parents are trying to establish or being willing actually to disclose that information. I guess that's the price you have to pay. But it is somewhat private information that needs to be disclosed. So,
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, Representative Nornes, you should know that actually federal privacy guidelines under FERPA, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, prevent a student from seeing their parents' tax information on that FAFSA. So there is a wall between the student and parent. So if a parent discloses, the student does not see that information. So there is some privacy for the parent in that. However, if a parent chooses not to disclose on the FAFSA their tax information, their student is essentially ineligible for federal student loans, federal grants, as well as state aid. Because there are very few exceptions to the reporting rule. So foster care youth, there are a few domestic violence situations. There's a few doors that a student can walk through if the parent's unwilling, but in most cases, those doors are not open for the general student.
Representative Daniel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going to follow up on Bud's question. Is it strictly income, like W-2 income, or is it income plus assets determine what they qualify for, state and federal?
Representative Fergus. Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, Representative, it is income plus assets plus information about the parent. So, for example, it will ask the parent and the student to disclose the amount in their checking and savings account if there's any assets. It does not ask, for example, about home equity. That is not an asset that's used for this process. It will ask about other general assets such as 529 plans, though. Also, in terms of... I was going to add something there, but now I forgot.
Yeah. Well, when you think of it, Ms. Fergus, you just raised your hand there, and you can mention it. I have one follow-up question to that. So what about students if they have assets of their own, they've been saving up for college, does that get counted into going against them being able to reach, not against, but does it count against them in getting state aid or federal aid?
Madam Chair, it does count against them. Student assets do count against them for federal aid purposes, so federal Pell Grants in particular. However, the state of Minnesota, if they're a dependent student, does not take those assets into account. So if the student is 18 to 24 and they're saving for college, we do not count that against them.
Okay. Representative Pryor.
Vice Chair Pryor. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Bernardi. It's fun to have someone that can answer everybody's questions. We really, really appreciate that. what Representative Claiborne was talking about before, if someone is an independent and doesn't have that parent's income, but their income, then they're two-thirds of the count, no matter, even if they're a child without income or a young adult without income, they would still be responsible for two-thirds? I just need to understand that a little bit better. Yeah.
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's not two-thirds. It's two payments. And depending on the student and spouse's income and assets, they may be assigned a second family responsibility of zero.
Okay.
So it depends. If they're truly the low income, for example, they receive some sort of federal benefits, food stamps is the one that comes to mind, they likely will be assigned a family responsibility of $0.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. However, all students are subject to the first 50% of costs. And that is regardless of income and assets.
Okay. And if I, one more on a different tangent.
Prior.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Bernardi. This is just parents have to report their income just to establish, but it doesn't mean that they have to contribute to the tuition.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. It will assign them a payment responsibility, but under no way do they have to pay it. That burden can go on the student instead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've had some discussion with constituents that were, one example was a grandparent who was contributing to the federal program of a education savings account, and they're getting a deduction off their taxes. Would those vehicles be something that would be taken into account on the income because they can be structured to help pay for multiple people. So how do you handle that complexity?
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, Representative, if the college savings plan is not in the student or the parent's name, then it actually does not count. So, for example, a grandparent that is saving and providing funds to multiple grandchildren, that actually is not taken into account. It is only if the account is in the name of the parent or the student. Yep.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, but it has to be a relative?
Ooh.
Because otherwise, you could have two families get together and have an account for each other's children, and then be able to not have it count against. I'm just curious about some of the complexities.
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, Representative, I actually cannot answer that question. I would have to check with our 529 staff on that specific answer.
Ms. Grimes.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, the tax benefit for what are called 529 college savings plans, and they're called 529 plans because that's the number of the Internal Revenue Code that they're under.
Yeah.
Only applies to relatives. I would have to double check, but I believe that the advantage to using a college savings plan is that the interest on the money that you put in that college savings plan is not subject to taxes as long as it gets used for qualifying post-secondary education expenses. I'm pretty sure that it has to be a relative in order for them to get that tax, to qualify for that tax advantage on the interest earnings. But we can double check and get back to you.
Okay.
Representative Quam.
So what I'm hearing is that families could get together and set up equivalent funds for each other's children as long as it's not the mother and the father, then those funds would not be counted.
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, Representative, we do not believe they would be counted, but again, we'll have to check with our 529 staff. Yep.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Ms. Fergus. I did remember the other thing I was going to mention. The FAFSA does take into account the context of the family. And so parents who are retirement age, over age 62, are actually treated differently than younger parents. Custodial parents are treated differently from non-custodial parents. Also, if both parents are working, they are treated different than if only one is working. So there are some contextual factors that go into the formula as well.
Ms. Grimes.
And just to piggyback on that, if the family has two or three children in college at the same time, they're not expected to come up with two or three times as much money. Their assigned family responsibility is divided in two or three, depending on how many students they have in college at the same time.
And Ms. Fergus, I wanted you to, could you comment on when you talked about custodial, non-custodial parents? Mm-hmm. So a situation would be someone's living with their biological parent and that person is remarried to someone who is the stepfather. Could you please explain to the committee how that that stepfather and the biological father play into FAFSA?
Madam Chair, yes. So the parent, for the purposes of the FAFSA, the parent who is actually where the student lives more than 50% of the time is the parent that's required to report their income and assets. So, for example, if you have a student living with their mother, and even if the mother is remarried, if the student is living there more than half time, that is the income and asset group that is actually looked at for FAFSA purposes, not the biological father with whom the student is not living, regardless of his income or assets.
Yeah. Or responsibility for payments.
Correct.
Right. And then so the stepfather in the situation's income would be accounted for, and is that different than custodial and non-custodial, or were you just talking about something totally different when you said custodial and non-custodial parents are treated differently?
Madam Chair, when I was referencing custodial parent, I was thinking about the parent with whom the student lives more than 50% of the time, so the primary home of the student, yes. So in that case, the biological father, because the student doesn't live there more than 50% of the time, I was considering him non-custodial.
Gotcha. Yeah. Thank you.
Yep.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wondering, so the application, FISA, has to be repeated every year then that the student's in college?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, it is required to be done each year. The two caveats is that continuing students get what is called a renewal FAFSA, so most of their income pre-populates from their first-year application, and you can just click the button to have your IRS data transferred over to your application. That would be the main difference. Yes.
Okay, and then, Ms. Fergus, I just want to let you know, if we're asking questions that you have future slides that you're going to educate us about that, you can just let us know that, and we can wait, and then if we have further questions, we can ask those at that time. So you just let us know, because this is very helpful and interesting, and I like the free flow of questions. But if we're asking previewing stuff to come up, you just let us know.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, we have another question. Representative Lehman. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just following up on the earlier question about the independent student, because maybe I'm the only one that's not clear on this. So if you're an independent student, you're on your own, you said that you still have to take on your own assigned student responsibility plus the assigned family responsibility. But if the assigned family responsibility could be zero up to the same amount as a student, and the independent student doesn't have a family, how do you determine what their family responsibility portion is?
Could you repeat that question? No, I'm just kidding. Ms. Fergus.
Roll the tape.
Madam Chair, Representative Lehman. So for example, if a student is not working, so say their adjusted gross income is $10,000, they would have to pay the assigned student responsibility, but because their income is so low, they would likely have a family responsibility of $0. However, if the student is single, no children, and working full-time before they go to college, and they're making, say, $45,000 a year adjusted gross income, then yes, they would be required to pay the assigned student responsibility, and they would be assessed a contribution based on that income.
Yep. Okay, thank you.
Okay. And as you move on, Ms. Fergus, could you just say what page you are on?
Correct.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, I'm moving to slide 16. Slide 16 shows essentially the math formula for a Minnesota state grant. All of the components you see there on the screen are actually parameters that are set in state law or session law. And so those are all items that you can change. And so we'll walk through each of those parameters. As you can see by the notes, we have changed a few of them over the years. So the first component is tuition, fees, and living and miscellaneous expense. The statute reference is 136A, 121, subdivision 6. And as I mentioned before, it essentially says that the average tuition and fees is set to the highest at a public institution. If the highest at a public institution or less, if they're actually charged less for a two-year program or a four-year program. You should note that we do not do it by type of institution. We actually do it by the student's program of enrollment. So if they are at St. Kate's in a two-year program, they will be charged the same amount as a Normandale student. If they are in a four-year program at St. Kate's, their award will be based on the same tuition fees as a University of Minnesota Twin Cities student. So it is by program length. In terms of the tuition fee maximums for the 18-19, the current year, the maximum allowable is $14,790, which is the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and $5,790, which is a Normandale Community College. And this is essentially tuition plus general fees charged to the student. The student may be charged program-specific fees, and those are not counted. So if they're in a very specialized program, they may have additional fees. In terms of living and miscellaneous expenses, we actually use the federal poverty threshold plus a modifier. So current state law is that it's set to 101% of poverty guidelines for a single individual for a nine-month period. The purpose of that is to essentially state that we want students to have a frugal standard of living when they are college students. In terms of what that actually looks like, so as I mentioned before, OHE actually increased the living miscellaneous expense to $9,900 this year. That compares to a poverty guideline amount of $9,105. And then the U.S. Department of Labor actually tells us that college students 18 to 24 actually spend about $12,679 in a year. And this would be on room, board, health care, transportation, gas, utilities, clothing, et cetera. That's kind of what their living standards are.
Ms. Fergus, I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. So you said a year, and then it's in parentheses it says 9 months. So does it get, is it three quarters of a year, and they're required to, like, work the other time, and that's why they don't need living expenses? Can you, that whole 9 months, and then you said a year at the same time. Can you explain that?
Yes, Madam Chair. So typically financial aid is awarded on an academic year basis, and by that we mean fall plus spring semesters typically. However, if a student enrolls in summer, our state financial aid programs, such as the state grant program, actually recognize 150% to kind of cover that state, that summer term. So, yes. Yeah. So we base everything on just fall and spring, and that's typically what we mean by an academic year. But the student does have eligibility in summer as well. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Proceed.
In terms of tuition and fees.
Okay, excuse me. We did have a question. Oh. Representative Cleburne.
I'm very sorry for the disruption. Thank you, Chair Bernardi. So on this chart with the living expenses allowance benchmarks on page 19, we have the, I just want to make sure I understand the numbers. The $12,679 is what students are actually spending? Is that what I heard you say?
Ms. Berger.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. And that is based on all college students regardless of income.
Okay, so that leaves us a gap of $8,721.
Ms. Ferguson.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. The question that comes into play is that $800 being spent on something that's education related or another kind of expense item, such as entertainment, travel. So that's where the frugal notion comes in. What do you expect a student to live in terms of a frugal standard of living as opposed to the average standard of living? Yep.
All right, thank you.
Okay, Ms. Fergus, please proceed.
Yep. The second half of the chart shows you what the maximum tuition fees allowable are for two-year and four-year programs as compared to the average charge currently this year. So the two-year program maximum is set at $5,790. That compares to an average tuition at Minnesota State Colleges of $5,443. For the four-year programs, it's $14,790. That compares to a state university average of $8,450 and a private college, private nonprofit college average of $34,850. Yep. In terms of what students pay, we essentially, policy is based on what's called the benefits received principle, which is also under 136A-121. And that is students enrolling in post-secondary education will receive a benefit from that education through increased employment opportunities, wages, et cetera, and therefore they should be responsible for a portion of the cost. It is currently set at 50% in state law. It has varied, though. It started at 50% in 1983 and then dropped to 46% in the late 90s, but then came back up to 50% just after, during the recession.
Okay. Thank you.
In terms of what that actually means, what we're seeing is that students at a Minnesota State College, we are asking them this year to pay $7,672 out of pocket after grants. A four-year student, just over $9,100. A University of Minnesota student, just over $12,000. And then a private university student would pay the $12,000 plus any other tuition fees we don't recognize in the program. In terms of what a student earns, a student working minimum wage half-time year-round essentially takes a gross earnings of $9,650. So we are expecting students to contribute pretty much all of their earnings if they are working half-time to the cost of college. In addition, first-year students may take out a federal student loan of approximately $5,500. So those are typically the resources that are available to students to pay their payments assignment.
Okay, so members, I just want to pause here for a moment. Does anybody have questions about this sheet? Because I think this is important sheet, and I don't want to gloss over it too quick because you may need to process a question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Representative Cleburne?
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. So these numbers are actually quite alarming when you are considering the cost of going to college. So this $9,650 you stated is gross earnings.
Gross earnings.
Okay, I just want to make sure everybody heard that. Gross earnings. Okay. And then, but we're still saying that there's already a
a $10,756 shortfall between what people are spending for their rent and what they're allotted for their rent over a four-year period of time. Oh. So if you took the $9,990 that students are allocated for their living expenses, but knowing that the actual cost, especially since the Twin Cities is not an economically low-cost housing market, that ends up being $10,000 over the 4 years that they would be there. So I just want to make sure that those numbers are accurate and clear.
Ms. Right? Burgess.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. If I boil it down to, we are asking students to pay more than they likely have wages and loans available for. Yes, we are.
Thank you.
Yep. Madam Chair and members, just so you can see it in terms of wages, a two-year student, we are currently expecting them to work 837 hours a year. The typical best practice benchmark is 600 hours per year, which would be approximately 10 hours per week during fall and spring semesters and 20 hours per week during the summer. If they choose to work beyond that, we would kind of leave that for their purposes as opposed to the cost of college. Yep. This is actually down from 1983 when we required them to work 1,044 hours. So we're headed in the right direction, but I do believe that the downward trend has more to do with the increase to the minimum wage than it does to kind of affordability within Minnesota.
Yes. Okay, so I'm still having grasped this whole chart here. And so one of the questions that I would like to ask is federal student loan amount, is that people have, my question is, students have to be eligible to receive that, or any student can receive that? And then my second question would be, what other types of loans do students and families take out for college? Ms. Burgess.
Madam Chair, members, yes, federal student loans, there are eligibility requirements. Number one, you have to complete the FAFSA. Number two is you have to be enrolled at least half time, so 6 credits or more per semester. So your students who are only taking one class will not qualify for a federal student loan. Federal student loans are the primary source of loan aid for students in Minnesota because typically other loan programs, such as the Minnesota Self-Loan Program, which is operated by our office, or federal PLUS loans or private bank loans, such as those you get from Wells Fargo or U.S. Bank, will require a co-signer. So typically a parent, a sibling, will have to also sign that loan application. And that means that a vast majority of low-income students will not access those other loans to pay for college. Yep.
Madam Chair. Ms. Grimes.
If I could just follow up on that. The data on what students actually borrow show that in Minnesota, 85% of all student loans are federal student loans. And so the other 15% consist of federal parent loans called PLUS loans, private student loans from banks like Wells Fargo or wherever, and some Minnesota self loans.
Yeah. And Madam Chair, okay, these amounts will actually increase. So a sophomore would actually be able to borrow $6,500 and a junior or senior $7,500 if they're a dependent student. If you are an independent student, you are allowed to borrow $7,500 a year, and then it increases as well. So in your first year.
Okay, so I'm going to give a quiz, and we'll go on after everybody gets 100% on it. So I really do want members to ask questions if they have questions about this. And while you're doing that, I do have a question. You know, I don't hear students coming in my office saying that they're working 10 hours a week and going to college. That doesn't seem like a reality. So could you explain, Ms. Fergus, how that is, why that doesn't line up? I'm asking you to analyze now and give me your opinion, but can you explain where the disconnect is, or however you think would be helpful for the committee?
Madam Chair, that's an interesting question. There are a couple of philosophies by which you can look at work. Number one, we actually do want students to work while they're in college. Ideally, we want them to work on campus or for a college-related employer activity. The reason we do want that, and we do mean that about 10 hours per week, not a ton, is that because that helps them build their sense of community. They start to feel like a member of the community. They spend more time on campus. They're more likely to stay enrolled. They're more likely to pass their classes and develop peer relationships. So it yields college success outcomes when they work on campus. That said, we do know that low-income students in particular may be working to help fund family obligations or may have expenses that go beyond what we expect a frugal student to have. So if they have a spouse and a child, they may be paying for childcare. If they have transportation expenses with a long commute, they may be paying for that. If they don't live with their family, they may be paying rents that are higher than what we expect a frugal college student to pay. And in that case, most students will increase the amount of work they do. And it becomes a point where as the student increases the number of hours they work, they have fewer hours available to spend in class, studying for class, or other academic kind of pursuits. And that's where we see the tipping point where we start to see students have lower outcomes academically. They're more likely to drop out. They're more likely to work full time and not stay in college. They're more likely not to pass their classes. And so managing that work component is one of the most critical things in terms of financial aid and affordability.
Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just, again, please bear with me. So we now have tuition at the University of Minnesota as the basis. I'm using a four-year institution. So tuition is going to cost $49,380. Then we
Representative Cleavorn, are you talking over 4 years?
Over a four. Okay, this is these are 4 year numbers. Yeah, thank you. So, tuition is $49,380 without extra fees, and that's the bare minimum. Okay. Then they are going to be allotted $39,960 to pay for housing costs if they're the frugal student. And since we live in a non-frugal city, I'm going to add $10,756 more dollars to that non-frugal marketplace. So the cost is now going to give us $100,096 for this four-year journey. But because we're a hardworking student and we're just going to max out that $9,650 gross earning dollars, we're going to deduct $38,600 from the cost of that $100,000 education. And our student, even after they've done nearly $40,000 of work, is going to be trying to figure out how to manage $61,496 at the ripe old age of 18 to 22.
Ms. Burgess.
Madam Chair, your math sounds correct. Yes.
Thank you.
Now, the ideal is that the parent will contribute and that the student will develop resources to spread out those living expenses and kind of hopefully bring costs down on the living expense side. But, yes, it is. That is why financial preparation for college is so critical.
Ms. Cleaver. I mean, Representative Cleaver.
Madam Chair, I would just like to say in all of these equations, children, students, don't get to pick their parents, nor do they get to pick their parents' financial literacy, capability, or extra burdens that may come to a family. So I just think this is a very large sum of money, and I would like to go on the record saying that this burden is extremely onerous to a student.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
And what I would like to add to this discussion is we haven't even mentioned the cost of books. Correct?
Madam Chair, books are actually including in living and miscellaneous expenses.
Books are in living.
Okay.
So you have to pay for them out of your $9,900. Yes.
Okay, so you taught something that books are included, but they're included as your living expense. I don't know if a student has ever like conveyed to me that they think of their books as a living expense. And so that's probably why I hear when people come into my office and I hear when I go to visit colleges and universities that students actually aren't, they're not all buying their textbooks. And it's pretty difficult. I mean, I learned that when I was in college right away. If I didn't read my textbook, which I owned, I didn't do well in class. So it took me a little bit to figure that out. But some students aren't even buying their books.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. Students are doing a lot of what we say book sharing options, textbook rentals, libraries. One student buys a book and another student splits the cost with them. Yep, students are very creative when it comes to helping mitigate that. But that is actually the one place where the governor's budget does recommend that we actually increase LME to cover books and supplies for college classes in his budget today. He did recommend that moving the LME to 110% of poverty to accommodate additional resources for books and supplies. That was included.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's more of a comment, but you somewhat just added some additional information from what I was going to mention. But when I was going to school full-time and working full-time, I was paying for my books by going to places like half.com. So there are private sector solutions. It just requires a person to think outside the box. And when a person thinks outside the box, not the standardized way of thinking, the conventional way of thinking, there are a tremendous number of solutions, both in reducing cost and able to achieve the objective. And that may include not completing in 4 years, right? It's not a rule that you have to finish in 4 years. I understand that there are collateral consequences for not being finishing in 4 years, but if you stretch it out longer, you can spread that dollar amount over a longer period of time as well, which also helps. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Madam Chair. Ms. Fergus?
In moving on to talk about what the family pays, we do assess family responsibility based on an ability to pay principal, that if the family has available income and assets, they should be expected to contribute to their students' educational costs, and that is determined by the FAFSA. For the state grant program, ability to pay does not vary by enrollment level, so if the result is that we think you can contribute $1,000 a year to the cost of college, it doesn't matter if your student is full-time or part-time, we still expect you to pay the $1,000 each and every year. And that includes if you extend it out for more than 4 years. We do note that the federal needs analysis or those contributions may be unreasonable for some students, specifically families between $40,000 and $90,000 of adjusted gross income. We do think they're coming in too high. Minnesota law allows us to reduce those by applying a modifier, which again is in 136A101 subdivision 5. Currently, the modifiers are 84% for dependent students, 70% for independent students with dependents, those are children usually, and 40% for independent students without children. And those two are set in state law.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you talk a little bit about why independent students with dependents, children, are expected to pay a higher percent compared to independent students without children?
Madam Chair, Representative Lean, yes. So remember how I talked about the FAFSA takes into account the family context when assessing those parent contributions? Students with children actually have some of the lowest contribution rates under the federal methodology. So they actually contribute usually less than 10% of adjusted gross income to the cost of college. Whereas students with no children, those independent students, are actually expected to contribute 47% of their income to the cost of college. So we're essentially applying a modifier to kind of even those out a little bit. Yep. And we still reduce the rate for children, for independent students with children. But we bring the independent without children student rate down much farther from the federal level. Yep.
Oh, man, Ms. Fergus, yep. I kind of lost you there. I don't know. I think it's my brain capacity, yep. But I wonder if you could slow down a little bit again. But Representative Lean and I saw Representative Cleaver were shaking their heads. They got it. But I'll ask them after committee to help explain that to me.
Madam Chair, the chart on the next page may actually help a little bit with that. So these are family types across the top. So we have parents of dependent students, independent students who are married with children, students who are single with children, and those who are married or single with no children. Based on their adjusted gross income, this is what they are expected to contribute to the cost of college under the state program. And so you can see at the $50,000 adjusted gross income, the parents of a dependent student under Minnesota would contribute just over $1,400 a year to the cost of college. Under the federal form, that is the what is equivalent to 84% of the federal contribution. That $1,400 is 84% of the federal contribution. So for Pell Grant purposes, they're probably being asked to contribute closer to $1,800. Yep. And so that's what it is. You can see that students who are married with children are actually not expected to contribute anything at $50,000 of adjusted gross income, and that is because of that family context. Students with children are allowed additional exemptions because they are assumed to have other expenses related to children. However, as you move over to the last column, which is students who are single but no children, at a $50,000 adjusted gross income, so this could be someone working full-time at, I wouldn't say a super high salary, but they would be expected to contribute $4,858 a year towards the cost of college in Minnesota. The student is not going to get any Pell Grants, though, because their income is too high to receive any federal assistance for educational costs. Yep.
Okay, so I do have a question here, and you may have it further on, so you can just say, just wait. Are you going to explain to us what makes a student qualify as being independent from their parents versus a dependent? Is that important in this conversation?
Madam Chair, absolutely, and I do not have it in my presentation, so that is a great question. A student qualifies as an independent student if, number one, they are over the age of 24. That's the biggest criteria. They also qualify as an independent student if they are an orphan, a ward of the state, or a foster care youth. They also can qualify as independent if they have homeless student status. They may also qualify as independent if they are married or have a child or are active military or a veteran. Anything I missed, Tricia?
Madam Chair, there are some occasions where there is domestic violence involved where a student who's age 18 to 23 could qualify as an independent student also.
Yep. Okay, so I have a follow-up question for that. I've had the perception, and I don't know if it's accurate, so like let's say a family member of someone's or grandchild or whatever goes out and lives on their own for a full year. They're not on their parents' taxes as dependent. Did you list them as?
No, Madam Chair. If they are under the age of 24, it does not matter their dependency status for tax purposes. It is only if they are married with child, active military, or the other exemptions do they qualify for independent student status. So their parent income and assets would still need to be reported.
Yeah. Madam Chair,
okay. Ms. Grimes.
30 or more years ago, there were some workarounds where people would try to do that. They'd go live away from their parents for a year and establish their and not be a dependent on their parents' income tax, and sometimes they could qualify as an independent student. But basically, the federal government saw that as a workaround and cracked down on it. And now it's extremely difficult if you're less than 24 years old to be counted as an independent student.
Okay, Representative Quam.
Foster children, as soon as they turn 18 and get out of high school, they are considered independent by the state. Do they then qualify?
Ms. Fergus. Madam Chair, Representative, yes. Foster care youth as well as orphans or wards of the state, provided they have the documentation required under federal law, are able to qualify as independent students.
Yep. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it possible for financial aid personnel to take into consideration a student's situation and do something outside of what you've listed here?
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, Representative Pommy, yes. Financial aid directors at individual colleges may take into account a student's circumstance within reason. It is not an open door for all circumstances, though. They must evaluate it on a case-by-case basis and provide documentation to back it up.
Okay, so now Representative Poppy is a counselor at a college, and I don't know what you two are talking about, so could you please explain to me what special circumstance would be, Ms.
Madam Chair, so if we use, for example, a domestic violence situation where the student was subject to child abuse by the parent, The student could provide documentation to the college that shows the domestic violence situation, and then they could be declared an independent student for financial aid purposes. Yes.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Yes, Ms.
Grimes. Example.
Sure.
So for example, the income that's used in calculating the federal expected family contribution and the state assigned family responsibility is taxable income from a previous year. If the one parent or the other got laid off, their income in the current year may be substantially less than the IRS income that can be verified. If they have a letter of layoff from their employer, for example, or they can show that they are receiving unemployment benefits, then the financial aid administrator can use what's called professional judgment to change the income that's counted when their financial aid eligibility is calculated.
Right. Well, that, okay, Ms. Fergus?
Madam Chair, I would add two things. The tax returns we use for purposes of financial aid are tax returns from 2 years ago. So essentially, students are being asked to report tax information from 2016 for the current financial aid cycle. So it's 2 years old. So you would have to show that any income loss was sustained over that two-year period from 2016 to 2018 in order to have that judgment made. Yes.
Interesting. I didn't know about that, and because I've seen that happen to families. My other question is, are you going to be talking about residency status when somebody becomes a resident and can qualify for these programs in Minnesota?
Madam Chair, I had not included that either.
Okay.
To be a resident for Minnesota purposes, you have to be living in the state for a 12-month period prior to attending college or have graduated from a Minnesota high school or meet one of the qualifying exemptions, such as a veteran returning and moving to Minnesota after military service. There's a few. Hurricane Katrina was another exemption that was allowed for a while as well. Movement related to Hurricane Katrina, yes. But it's pretty much 12 months in the state without attending college before enrolling.
Yep. Okay, thank you. You may move on, Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, the next section is just Pell Grants. Currently, Pell Grants range from $611 to $6,095. It will increase by $100 next year under the U.S. Department of Education budget that was passed in September. In addition, you should note that the distribution of Pell Grants varies by credit level. They have these kind of stair steps. And so when you apply the two in combination, state grant may look weird. But when you look at both of them together, our goal within the state grant program is to increase grants on a credit-by-credit basis. So for each additional credit the student takes, up to 15 credits, the state grant will pay up to 50% of the cost. Yep. In terms of just what it looks like, this is a picture of the actual state grant application pool. That giant blue mountain there, those are your dependent students. Two-thirds of our applicants are dependent students when it comes to the state grant program. And you can see, this is slide 30, that they are spread pretty much, not, I wouldn't say exactly evenly across the income spectrum, but definitely more plateau-like. Your independent students who are not married are the mountains that are on the far left of the chart, your green and white. I hope they show up that color. Whereas your married students are going to be the small lower hills in the front. So you can see that having two income earners in a family means that income is more distributed across the spectrum as opposed to one earner, which they're on the low side. Yep. So we just like to give a visual over what income distribution looks like. In terms of who receives the state grant, you can see that by income level and college they're attending, 61% of students who are earning less than $20,000 adjusted gross income attend a Minnesota State College. Those are our two-year public colleges, as opposed to students from families who are earning $120,000 adjusted gross income or more. You actually see 29% of them at private nonprofit colleges and 33% at the University of Minnesota. We do know that there is a definite income correlation to where a student chooses to attend college. Low-income students choose to attend low-cost institutions primarily.
Yes. Okay. We have a question from Vice Chair Breyer.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. Just back on to slide 30, and I know that there's an explanation for it. I don't know if it's simple,
yeah.
But it's such a strange graph. when you see on the right-hand side that huge spike. Yes. So can you tell us a little bit about where that spike comes from?
Thank you, Ms. Fergus. That spike, if we didn't stop the graph at 200,000, it would likely continue out. We actually track income up to about $1 million before it's top-coded. So those students are $200,000 more. They're just all lumped into one group at the end. And normally it just peter off.
And, Madam Chair, if I may add, this is applicants for aid. This is not recipients of aid.
Right.
Yep. And let me ask you a follow-up on that.
Did you have another follow-up?
No, that was probably the follow-up that you're going for.
Well, no, you go for it, and then I'll follow up. Go ahead.
Right. So as you said, so it's Vice Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Bernard. So the idea that it's applicants, so the $1 million income, turns out they're getting anything. Yeah.
Madam Chair, it is possible that even a high-income family will decide to have their student take out a student loan.
Okay.
But not receive a state grant.
Right.
Okay, so my question to that is, and I gotta capture it again, and maybe I'm not going to capture it. Just give me a second here. I'll maybe catch it again. So we'll see.
Right.
Must not have been that important. Okay. So any other questions? Okay. Continue on.
Madam Chair, on slide 32, we'd like to show you, this is the income profile of students by the college they can attend. So you can see dependent students, which are the blue bars, range in average income, median income, from about $51,000 at a state two-year college up to about $93,000 median income at the University of Minnesota. For independent students, it actually is more even. And so it's about $21,000 across all types of colleges. But just to give you a sense of the income profile of students who are applying.
Yep. Okay, my question did come back to me. My question was going to be a follow-up. You have this information on students. These are applicants because a lot of times some people don't think they're going to get any FAFSA, but they still are required to when a child goes to college or something. Can you just say what the requirement is, and is that why you have all this data on other students, even though they don't get anything? Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, so our office receives a copy of your FAFSA if you are a Minnesota resident, regardless of where you plan to go to college, or if you are a non-resident student attending a Minnesota college. So we do receive about 600,000 FAFSAs each year, both for undergraduate and graduate students. This pool is limited to simply those who are eligible for a Minnesota state grant. So that 130,000 students would be Minnesota residents attending a Minnesota college who are undergraduates. Yes. You do have to file a FAFSA to gain access to federal student loans. So we do encourage families to file the FAFSA because federal student loans come with extensive borrower protections and they come with lower interest rates than private student loans.
Ms. Grimes.
Madam Chair, there are some families who do not file a FAFSA because maybe they filed one the first year and they weren't eligible for a state grant or Pell grant and they didn't file one in succeeding years. However, for example, the private colleges and the University of Minnesota provide a fair amount of scholarship income that's from donated money. And oftentimes, colleges and the University of Minnesota require the family to file a FAFSA even to get merit aid or other kinds of scholarship money. So Meredith probably knows the percentage of all students who file a FAFSA.
Well, it's 86% of new entering
students. That's right.
Okay. Okay.
It's about 70% of all college students, though, in Minnesota.
But not all colleges require someone to do a FAFSA.
If you do not need federal or state financial aid, you are not required to file a FAFSA. No.
Okay. Thanks.
Yep. And we do have families who do opt out each year. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And especially as the economy improves, more families opt out. And so,
Representative Brombeck has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you mentioned something about the difference between the two types of loans, federal loan, right, versus state or private loan. You said one had more protection than the other?
Correct, Fergus. Madam Chair, Representative, yes. Federal student loans do come with what we call borrower protections. So, for example, the loan is in the name of a student. So if the student should die or become disabled, the student can actually get their loan, what is the word I'm searching for? Paid off, forgiven?
Forgiven.
Waived, forgiven? Forgiven. And so they don't have to continue to paying on it. In addition, there are 9 repayment options under federal student loans. And some of them are based on income. Some of them are more standard repayment plans. But the student has a variety of options for how they pay that federal loan back. In addition, each year, the U.S. Department of Education, as part of its budget, Congress sets what the interest rates are going to be for federal student loans. For the last couple of years, probably the last 5 or 6, they've been at 3.6% interest rates. And if any of you have applied for a home loan, you'll know that private market rates are actually 4.5% right now. So they are subsidized below. Yeah.
But Madam Chair and Ms. Fergus, the federal loan does not allow you to file bankruptcy and get out from under it. Isn't that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative, actually no educational loan can be discharged in bankruptcy, private, state, or federal, unless you have extreme circumstances, and the courts are still deciding what that extreme circumstance is. Mm-hmm. Okay. There are some exceptions if you, such as institutional fraud or colleges that have closed, that's our most recent cases, you can get your federal student loan discharged in certain circumstances if you have been subject to that. But again, very narrow circumstances, yes.
Okay. Madam Chair,
Ms. Grimes.
There is a federal repayment plan called income-based repayment that is based on the borrower's income. And if borrowers know that is an option, they really should not have to default on their student loans. Defaulting on a loan means not paying on it for 9 months or more. Because if their income is low enough, basically below 150% of poverty, their payments that year are zero, and it's not screwing up their credit, and it's not being reported as not being paid. So that is, there are income-based plans that can help borrowers who are struggling to repay their loans.
Okay, so what I'm going to propose here now, because I see we have a number of pages left, I'm going to propose that we let our presenters go through the rest of them and hold your questions. So write them down because I think they're great questions. And then I did notice you skipped over like 4 sheets or something earlier. So if we have time, we're going to go back to that.
Okay.
Okay.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. Okay. Yep. So I might talk a little bit faster now.
Okay. Oh, no. and then we did, I just want to make sure, we're told that you two are available tomorrow, if our members do have other questions. Is that accurate?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay,
go ahead, Ms. Slide 33, Madam Chair and members, shows the distribution of Minnesota State grant recipients. You can see that 60% of students receiving a state grant have an adjusted gross income of less than $40,000. However, we do go up the income spectrum. Therefore, we always encourage middle-income students to file a FAFSA just to see if they will qualify for a Minnesota State grant. In terms of spending, this is the total spending. You can see the green bars is where federal Pell Grant spending is concentrated. So approximately $61 million of Pell Grant funds flows to students whose adjusted gross income is less than $10,000. Then, in addition, the state provides just under $24 million to that same group in Minnesota state grants. However, as you move into the middle income, the state grant is meant to complement the Pell Grant by extending financial aid up the income spectrum. You actually see more state grant dollars beginning at about $40,000 of adjusted gross income through about $100,000. Typically, state grant eligibility tapers off at about $90,000 adjusted gross income unless the family has more than one child in college. Yep.
Okay.
On slide 35, these are the average amounts that a student would receive, the green being the Pell Grant and the blue meaning the state grant. So for our lowest income group, the less than $10,000 adjusted gross income, they're receiving, on average, both full-time and part-time students, about $4,350 in federal Pell Grants, and then an additional amount is applied to Minnesota State Grant to bring that total up to $60,050, which would be $1,700 difference in the state grant. As you move up the income spectrum, you can see at about $80,000, the Pell Grant contributes pretty much nothing or negligible, and so the full $3,200 is largely state grants. Yep. In terms of what chart 36 is, simply a table showing you the number of recipients by sector, as well as their combined Pell Grants and state grant dollars. So we just like to detail it out by type of college. Yep. And remember, the state grant awards grants based on the cost of the institution as well as student and family income and assets. And so lower students at lower cost institutions do receive lower state grants than students at higher cost institutions. So you'll see that is why the percentages of recipients don't match the percentages of dollars. Yeah. On slide 37, this is a new chart we're trying out, and I'll just tell you, people don't really like it. But it has an important message. And this is the percentage of students who from fiscal year 17 were still enrolled in college in fiscal year 18 within the state grant database. And so you can see for our lowest income students, about 64% of state grant recipients were still enrolled in college in fiscal year 18. But what that means is actually the opposite. That means 36% of students from that lowest income left college and did not graduate in fiscal year 17. 36%. As compared to the upper income, the $120,000, where the state grant number is 83% of them continued their education or graduated, which means only 17% left without a degree. We do like to remind individual students that higher education is never going to be affordable unless you complete college, because it really is that credential, be it a one-year certificate, a two-year associate degree, or a four-year bachelor's degree, that yields the highest wage outcomes post-college as compared to students who did not enroll in college at all or those who left without receiving that credential. Yeah. Slide 38 is simply a time trend to show you what the average state grants and total spending are from 1997 to the present. Slide 39 is a comparison across states. So Minnesota ranks 17th in total state grant funding to undergraduates. The highest is, of course, California, who awards just over $2 billion a year in financial aid. The blue bars are need-based grants. The green bars, such as Georgia, are actually merit-based or non-need-based grants. Those are scholarships based on academic performance. Some states do that scholarships as opposed to need-based grants. And then a number of states like Tennessee and Florida actually mix the two. Yeah. In terms of spending per undergraduate, Minnesota spends on financial aid about $873 per full-time undergraduate. This compares to New York, who spends about $1,100, and, of course, South Carolina, who spends just under $2,200 per undergraduate. Yes. In order to reach the New York level, we would have to increase spending in the state grant program by approximately $50 million a year based on our number of undergraduates. Yes. Many of the states who actually have free college programs are the states who are listed above us in terms of total spending per undergraduate. And just on that note, Madam Chair, our most frequently asked question of the last year is, does Minnesota have free college under the Minnesota State Grant Program? The chart you see on slide 42 shows you that if you are a full-time student at Minnesota State and you're a dependent, you do get 100% of tuition and fees covered, plus a little bit more for living expenses if your adjusted gross income is less than $45,000. If you are an independent student with children, it is $60,000 adjusted gross income or less. If you're an independent student without children, it is $25,000 adjusted gross income or less is where you receive 100% coverage. At Minnesota State 4 years, it is up to $35,000 in adjusted gross income. And because at the University of Minnesota, the higher tuition, pretty much Pell plus state grant, no student receives 100% of tuition and fees covered. Yep. Madam Chair, that is the end of my slides.
Okay, so I want to go back to page 37. You said that it was the hard one to understand, but it had an important message.
Correct.
So let's just start at where it says less than 10,000.
Mm-hmm.
It shows who receives state grants. And it says 64%, and then the other number is about 48% for the other two categories.
Yep.
Does the difference mean that the dropout rate is 60% greater? Than for those categories? Is that what that means? And how many students would this, like, do you know a number of students?
Do you have a number? It would be, hold on, let me flip back. The number of students hasn't decreased or hasn't changed all that much. So in that category this year, we have approximately 14,000 students across all three groups. This chart, the 64% represents students who receive a state grant. The 48% actually represents two groups, students who received a Pell Grant only, so they could be part-time at a two-year college and not receive a state grant, or students who did not receive either a Pell Grant or state grant. So there may have been something disqualifying them from aid at that income level, such as a high assets, high number of assets.
Yeah. So what does that, Ms. Fergus, does that mean that people who receive state grants have a better, generally have a better chance of graduating from college?
Madam Chair, this is only measuring continued enrollment from year, essentially fiscal year 17 to fiscal year 18, but yes, both in terms of national research as well as in terms of studies that we've done within our office, students who receive financial aid typically have higher outcomes once you control for income than students who do not receive financial grants. And so that would be both Pell Grants and state grants. However, in most cases, if a student is receiving Pell Grant only, they may be part-time, and so that is likely another factor to come into play. Full-time students also tend to stay in college longer and complete at higher rates than part-time students. Yes.
Okay, members, do we have other questions? I'm trying to go back to this. I was going back to pages like 26, 27, and 28. Did you talk about that and I missed it?
Oh. Madam Chair, I skimmed over it.
Okay, I noticed that.
It was like 30 seconds max.
Okay, yep.
I did also forget to mention the other recommendations from the governor's budget as well, which are referenced in that section.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, slide 26, 27, and 28. Pell Grants are awarded in what we call banded credits. So you receive one Pell Grant if you are enrolled in 1 to 5 credits. You receive another Pell Grant. It bumps up another amount if you're in 6 to 8 credits, and then it bumps up again at 9 to 11. They don't do the per-credit basis for Pell Grant. They do bands, which simplifies the awarding process, but it creates the stair step. And so when we take into account state grants, we're essentially trying to fill in those stair steps. And so a student, if you look at state grants by itself, it'll look really weird like this. It'll go from zero up to $1,000 and up and down. But it's because we're trying to achieve the effect on slide 28, which is to fill in those stair steps and make it an even increase across the credit levels. Yep, we do want state grants to increase with each additional credit the student takes. Because tuition comes with that additional credit, typically. Mm-hmm. So, yes. You pay a portion of the cost. Yes. All right.
Other questions?
Okay. Well, I want to... go ahead.
Madam Chair, Fergus.
I forgot to mention on slide 23 that the governor has recommended reducing the modifiers. They have been reduced. They were reduced in the last session as well. But he has recommended reducing these modifiers by an additional 6 points. So the 84% on slide 23 would be reduced to 78. This seems odd, Nicole. Yeah. And the 40% would go down to 34. Yep. Does the 70 go down to 64? I think we have a typo. Is it 70?
I thought 70 was the result.
Yeah, we're not sure that there's the 70% is what we're questioning. So
okay, but are you saying, Ms. Fergus, that it did go down 6%, whatever 6 points, whatever the number is, it did go down 6 points?
The governor has recommended it go down 6 percentage points. Yes,
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Any particular reason why? Just to manage Office of Higher Ed budget, to manage the state grant dollars. I saw the report was just came out today, and it was about $20 million short in this biennium, but going out the next biennium, it looked okay.
Ms. Burgess.
Madam Chair, Representative Lean, what Representative Lean is referencing is the spending projection. We do, we are on track for spending this year. For the next year, we do estimate that should you change nothing within the state grant program, that the program will actually underspend its appropriation by $20 million. Yes. That $20 million would be the equivalent of keeping the LME at this year's level. So, yes, there is $20 million currently unallocated if you consider current state law. The governor is recommending that we spend that $20 million and add an additional about $32 to $34 million to actually increase the size of grants to students. And one of those recommendations is to reduce these modifiers because that will increase grants for specifically for families whose income is $30,000 to $90,000 and reduce the family contribution that you see on those slides. Yes.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, just for clarification, so is it trying to get more people into the program or more dollars to the people who are already in the program?
Ms. Burgess.
Madam Chair, Representative Lee, the primary goal is to get more money to middle-income students to offset that high family contribution we require of them. However, each time you increase the state grant award, you are increasing eligibility, and so we do pull in some upper-income people into the program, or those who are just below the threshold this year of eligibility. Yes.
Madam Chair, Representative Lean, the governor's recommendation would increase average state grants to the existing 81,000 recipients by about $300 and would pull in an additional 4,700 new recipients.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So then when that, I have a question, when that $20 million is spent, you know, to get it to, you're trying to get it to students, does that count as new spending or does that just try, is that old? You know, is that at, when you're coming to ask for $54 million mm-hmm. more for grants?
Yes.
Is that $20 million new spend, considered new spending? Could you just?
Yep, Madam okay, Chair. And actually, I confused myself as well in this process. The governor's recommendation is to add $54 million to the appropriation for state grant and spend the $20 million that is projected to be underspent, which means that the total changes recommended by the governor actually equal $74 million. Did I say that right, Trisha?
Right.
Yes.
I did follow that amazingly, but my question then is, I want to figure out how that comes out of, do you have to have state legislate, do you have to change law to get that $20 million into the hands of students? Is it something required by the legislature to make that happen?
Ms. Yes, Kurgis. Madam Chair, we would ask that you change the LME from 101% of poverty. So to spend the $20 million, you would need to change it to 109% of poverty, and the governor is actually recommending you change it to 110% of poverty. Yeah.
But Madam Chair, you know, if you look back to fiscal years 18 and 19, so in fiscal year 18, enrollment was less than what had been expected, and so there was some money that carried over to 19. And rather than letting that money just sit there unspent, the office had the authority to temporarily, for 1 year, increase the living and miscellaneous expense allowance in order to get that money into the hands of students.
Okay.
So instead of the living and miscellaneous expense allowance for the second year being around $9,100, it was $9,900.
Okay, that's helpful. Okay, wow. Thank you for your presentation. We were very engaged, and I'm hoping members learned a lot as well. And thank you for making yourself accessible to our members tomorrow if they have further questions. We appreciate your work. With that, the meeting is adjourned.